So whether you care about the cost of prescription drugs because your grandma's having to cut her pills in half, you can't get that done unless we do some kind of federal legislation. But to do the federal legislation, we got to first have a political system that isn't being controlled by the pharmaceutical companies.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Nick Penniman is co-founder and CEO of Issue One, a leading bipartisan organization working to reform our democracy. Issue One wants to strengthen ethics laws, reduce the influence of big money on politics, modernize elections, and end what they call the pay-to-play culture in Washington. Before starting Issue One, Nick was a journalist, an editor, and publisher, including being co-founder and executive director of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. Nick is an experienced co-founder and CEO of multiple organizations with a history of working in philanthropy, media, politics, and social entrepreneurship. And he's the author of many articles and a book on democracy and political reform called Nation on the Take. I was happy to visit his office in D.C. to hear his story and learn about what Nick is up to with Issue One. With that as background, a quick word from our sponsor, and then my interview with Nick Penniman and Issue One.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Nick Penniman. I'm the founder and CEO of a political reform organization called Issue One. Issue One was founded 5 years ago with the explicit purpose of finding a bipartisan route to democracy reform, mainly at the federal level. We do some state work, but mostly we work in Washington. We've got 200 former members of Congress who have joined us, about half Republican, half Democrat, and a bunch of bills cooking in both the House and the Senate. I can tell you about some of our actual victories later in the broadcast. My background is that I was mainly a journalist for 20 years. I was a newspaper editor. I was a magazine publisher. I was publisher of the Washington Monthly magazine. I helped found a big piece of Huffington Post when it got going. I worked for years with Bill Moyers, the famous broadcaster, on various media initiatives. I suppose the reason why I'm doing this work is because I got kind of sick of being involved in creating media and content around what was wrong with Washington and wanted to dive in and try to see what I could do to help fix it.
So I'm very interested in how you fix what is wrong. But what's the quick diagnosis from your viewpoint?
Yeah. So I wish that I could say that there was one major problem, and if we just solve that problem, everything would be fine. And my diagnosis is slightly different than what we work on as an organization. Mine is broader than what we work on here at Issue One. I would say that money in politics is the big driver of the dysfunction, mainly the amount of time that members have to spend fundraising and then who they're fundraising from. Number two is gerrymandering. The fact that there are so few competitive seats in Congress right now means that members of Congress are constantly just having to run the base, right, because of the primary vote. Number three would be just a lack of civic engagement and relatedly disinformation. It's so hard to have a coherent national dialogue, political dialogue, when most Americans are living in either a right-wing information bubble or a left-wing information bubble, and we have no shared facts anymore. There's some other stuff we can talk about that's a little more esoteric but important, which is like the gutting of Congress and the support systems for members of Congress, the pathetic pay for members of Congress, the pathetic pay for congressional staff. There's just a lot of tweaks that we've made, really negative tweaks to Congress in the last 20 or so years that make it a really dysfunctional workplace beyond the big drivers of money and politics and gerrymandering.
So you said about 5 years ago you founded this.
Yeah.
So 5 years ago is well before the Trump election.
Yeah.
What's the founding story there? What was causing you to make that happen at that
time? Yeah. Well, at that point, when we were much more focused exclusively on money and politics, it was very clear to me that we weren't solving problems anymore as a country. We could, you know, make changes on the margins, but we weren't solving problems at the scale that they needed to be solved at. It's not a profound insight, but unless we can de-rig the system and reduce a lot of the noise that's in the system by special interests and wealthy individuals, it's going to be hard for us to ever achieve solutions at scale. So whether that's actually reducing the cost of healthcare, and we can talk about all the concessions that were made during the Obamacare debate to the pharmaceutical companies and why those were made, or whether it's climate change, or whether it's rebuilding the middle class in this country and dealing with the outflow of jobs and the collapse of the manufacturing sector and the threat of artificial intelligence that's emerging. We are facing more problems in our country right now than we ever have in my lifetime, and I'm almost 50. And I just don't think that we have the government that's capable of solving them anymore. And by that, I mean the self-government, not some government as if it were some island somewhere unto itself, but the ability to self-govern our way out of our problems.
What is Issue One, this thing that you founded? What is it?
So we are a political reform organization. Again, we work in a very bipartisan fashion for various reasons, which I can also explain. What we do is we produce reports about what we see going on in Washington around money and politics and lack of transparency and ethics and other things. And then we produce pieces of legislation. We work on solutions to try to fix them. So for instance, in the House right now, we've got a couple bills that are floating around. One would fix the Federal Election Commission because the FEC has been a very ineffective enforcement body around money and politics for way too long, and we've got good bipartisanship on that bill. And then in the Senate, we've got a number of provisions cooking, but our lead one right now is called the Honest Ads Act. And the purpose of that is to provide full transparency for digital political advertising. As you probably know, right now, if you and I were to take $100 million out of TV ads, we'd actually have to disclose enough stuff about who we are that the public would know who's running the ads. We could take out $100 million in digital ads tomorrow and not have to disclose a single thing about ourselves. We've got to be able to advance transparency because that's where the money's going. It's going online.
Off the top of my head, those don't sound like things that will pass on bipartisan fashion. But you say that you have good support. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, so if you look at the Honest Ads Act, mm-hmm. our co-sponsor in the Senate is Lindsey Graham. Mm-hmm. He's by no means a moderate Republican anymore. Mm-hmm. He's obviously aligned himself with the president quite a bit. And we're working on picking up additional sponsorship on the Republican side of the aisle. In the meantime, we've been working with Senator Grassley on an anti-foreign lobbying bill, also with Senator Grassley, Republican, on something called the Shell Company Abuse Act, because there are a bunch of folks who are starting to pump dark money into our elections through fake companies or shell companies. We're working with Senator Lankford, a Republican from Oklahoma, very conservative, on a provision to protect the ballot box next year, make sure that we reduce the potential for hacking and increase paper ballots and the ability to audit the elections. And then on the House side with the FEC, we've got more than a dozen Republicans co-sponsors on that bill. In addition to as many Democrats as we want, right? Because the challenge is never with this stuff as often as not getting the Democrats on board, but building enough bipartisanship around them. We've got genuine bipartisanship on every one of these things I just talked about. And yes, the key is to continue to snowball that and get it to the point where there's enough traction to get it done.
Yeah.
But we've got a good start.
What do you think the prospects are for each of these in the short term, say before 2020?
On the FEC, probably not. On the Honest Ads Act, I'd give it a 25-30% probability of getting done right now. But then once you get higher up the chain of kind of immediacy and intensity, like protecting the ballot. So Senator Lankford's bill, the Secure Elections Act, I think we've got like a 60-70% probability of seeing that pass, because I think that everyone, Republicans and Democrats—
Something the president would actually sign.
Yeah. If the Senate passes it,
yeah.
I think that it would be crazy for the president not to sign it, because that means at that point that it has Mitch McConnell's blessing and it's got 8 or 9 other Republicans on board.
So how did you get this going?
Yeah, there was a group of donors actually who were big political donors who had seen up front, because of the access that their political donations awarded them over the years, who had seen the system breaking down. They were interested in trying to create kind of new energy around democracy reform. And I knew a couple of them. And so I signed up and we founded the organization.
So they came to you as a potential person to run it?
It was kind of like a combination of factors, but we kind of came to each other at about the same time with the same impulses.
Who are these donors?
Some of them you can look them up on our website. Mm-hmm. Some of them are big Democratic donors. We've now got some big Republican donors also involved. We're funded by a mix of foundations, which is maybe 20-30% of our income, like the Hewlett Foundation, Democracy Fund, which was funded by Pierre Omidyar. You did a thing with Joe Goldman, I know.
I did, yeah.
And then a ton of individual donors. Mm-hmm. The individual donors give us anywhere from $200,000 to $5,000.
Mm-hmm. How did you go about staffing this?
Yeah, we started out relatively modestly. We had a staff of maybe a dozen or so for the first couple of years. And just in the last 2 years, we've started ramping up. So we now have a staff of 30 and a budget of $5 million. We've got 3 main programs that we run, one around foreign interference in our elections, one around just building a politically broader, stronger coalition for reform. How do we engage communities beyond the traditional left? And then another one on the stuff I talked about around congressional functioning, you know, the rules, the HR issues that members of Congress face and all that kind of stuff. In addition to that, we sponsor a website called The Fulcrum, thefulcrum.us, which we just helped found a couple months ago with a few guys from Roll Call, including David Hawkins, who was kind of like the star of Roll Call, specifically and exclusively for the purpose of covering the fight for political reform. It's like, you know, what Tennis Magazine is to the tennis community. Check out thefulcrum.us.
How's Fulcrum doing? Is it
doing well?
Yeah.
It's getting off the ground. I mean, we've got a very good developing readership and good subscribers to our newsletter. The notion there, and I think it's kind of why you're doing this podcast, is that the fight for political reform right now in our country is probably the most vital fight that any of us can be involved in. And all of the polling shows that the American public is really starting to lean in to these issues of how do we fix our political system? How do we create a more functional government? But they have very few places to turn to get information or insight into what's going on.
The model for political reform in our history has typically been sort of crisis,
right,
election of reformers, passage of legislation.
Right.
Right. Do you think that's what it requires here? Again, is like a post-Watergate class, things like the Federal Election Campaign Act that came out of that?
Yeah.
Is that what you're preparing for?
I think so. I'd rather that we not have to wait for the collapse and the crisis.
Yeah.
I feel like so much of what occurs legislatively in this country occurs because of that. You know, something happens, there's a panic, and then finally we're paying attention to things that we had been somewhat self-consciously neglecting for too long. I think that what's happened in the last couple years is that people have seen how profoundly dysfunctional our system is, and they are, again, kind of leaning in to this stuff as never before. So I think that in the, you know, in the next 5, 6, 7 years, we've got a huge opportunity to try to get some serious stuff done. But yeah, it'd be nice if it was more like, you know, we have the gutters cleaned on our home every year, right? I mean, it'd be nice if we routinely just try to upgrade and update and reform and renovate our democracy just because that's the right thing to do. But unfortunately, I'm not sure the world works that way.
Well, it does feel like we're being stress tested right now.
Yeah.
But you thought we were being stress tested before Trump,
oh,
right?
God, yeah. 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 I mean, we're looking at a 30-year decline here. We're at the end of a 30-year decline with our democracy.
We seem to be in a position where people, when polled, actually are exhibiting a lack of faith in the system.
Yeah.
Which is really
terrifying.
Scary. Yes.
Yeah. Not only lack of faith, but they're even starting to wonder whether or not democracy is worth it.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe we need a strong man.
Maybe we need a strong man. Yeah. Yeah. That scares me tremendously. And then you've got a whole generation of Americans like your kids and my kids who, you know, at least we were alive during the end of the Cold War, right? You and I were, when the Berlin Wall came down, and then our parents were alive to see World War II. Generations from age 40 up have an awareness of the existential clash between dictatorships and authoritarians and democracy. And we have a sense that that's a fight that's worth fighting. I think that the younger generations are almost clueless. So they have taken democracy for granted. They either don't really appreciate it or believe in it, or they're taking it for granted and don't realize that you can lose democracy.
I'm wondering, though, about your diagnosis for what's causing the problem, which seemed to be, I know you have a book about money and politics, yep. And a lot of your thinking seems to be, like, I'm guessing, is sort of that the system's been hijacked for private gain or corporate gain, or, but it feels like it's part of this worldwide trend towards experimenting with authoritarian systems that you see in Turkey or yep. Russia or whatever. How do we arrest these major trends yep. of like using immigrants as something to campaign against? Or yep. like, do you think really it's the money in politics, which seems like a small part of this in the big scene?
No. I think that there are, I mean, we can have the political dysfunction conversation, yep. but then there are other
causes. The trends of inequality dealing with, I mean, some of it
rapid
is just
migration too.
Huge changes that are part of the development of new technology, the path of capitalism.
Absolutely.
You know,
those are totally critical. You can't, it's very hard to maintain a democracy in a country that's under massive economic stress, because when people are under massive economic stress, they're looking for a way out. And oftentimes that's when authoritarians have the ability to step forward and claim that they've got the way out. It's also when authoritarians have the best chance of dividing the country culturally. And we're obviously seeing that too. So yeah, if we had all of the political dysfunction drivers in place that we have today, but had a really functional middle class that was growing and expanding, and if we didn't have the rate of migration that we currently have, so we weren't struggling with that too as a society, would, you know, there be so much pressure and attention on these political structural reforms? Don't know. But arguably, those are also there. And let me just correct one thing that you said about money and politics. Yeah, there is like the corruption issue that people talk about, the corporate capture of Washington issue. For me, having met so many members of Congress now, again, recruited 200 of them to my organization, former members of Congress, and working with dozens on the Hill, I have kind of a different, almost like weird insidery view of it, which is it's just exhausting them. The way that the system has been structured with the dark money, with the amount of fundraising they have to do, where they're spending 30 to 40 hours a week fundraising, it exhausts them. It takes everything out of them. You've got kids. Let's say your kids were all horribly sick all the time, and they never got better. And so you were expending so much energy day and night just like trying to keep them healthy. How well would you be able to do your job, right? You'd just be drained. You'd be so drained, you wouldn't be able to do your job well.
I could never contemplate myself running for Congress because I don't think I have the constitution to like stand in all day long in these sort of activities. Just
it seems so hard to imagine fixing the immigration problem or rebuilding the middle class and dealing with all the massive threats, the out-migration of jobs, AI, et cetera, unless we first have a functional government. So that's why I'm trying to kind of apply myself to that, because my metaphor for this is a surgeon needs good surgery tools. They need good instruments to work with. If you send a surgeon into surgery and the tools are bent and rusted, then there's no way the surgeon, regardless of how talented they are, is going to be able to perform surgery well. So I think the same thing is true of us as a country right now. Unless we have an effective government, an effective political system that can solve problems, then I don't think there's any way for us to get out of the collapse of the middle class, the stressor of a broken immigration system, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm very sympathetic to the reforms that you're proposing and that other people are working on really hard. And I think all of those would improve things.
Yep.
I think there's another model of fixing things, which is a partisan model, which is like we actually have the wrong people in charge, and that we might solve this by electing a huge number of Democrats that actually are more aligned with reform by ousting a president that is a threat to democracy. Why not go after a solution like that? Why choose a bipartisan path in a time where there really is a villainous party and a party that is much less so?
See, I don't see it as being a villainous party.
They've elected a really dysfunctional man with bad impulses, and they're supporting him.
Yeah. So let's say the Democrats at some point had elected a celebrity, like choose some Hollywood celebrity who gets in trouble relatively often, but for whatever reason, that some screen actor, right? Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck seems to get in and out of trouble, right, every so often. So Ben Affleck became president of the United States by power of his celebrity and because he seemed like an outsider and because he seemed like he'd shake things up, right, which is what Donald Trump promised. And the American public was so burned out and spent on all the career politicians. And then Ben Affleck became president, Democratic president, and he got into office and he was kind of reckless and, you know, defying Democratic norms and standards and saying stuff. And
I just don't think...
Do you think the Democratic Party would support him?
I don't know, actually. I think the parties are quite different. Ben Affleck might have a lot of problems as president of the United States.
Yeah.
But it seems unlikely that he'd be friend of Putin and friends of dictators and cozying up to North Korea's leaders. And
I'm not being an apologist for Donald Trump's embrace of authoritarians around the world. It scares me to death. I think that part of the problem with our politics today is that we so thoroughly vilify each other in the parties that we're incapable of finding the Venn diagram overlap of where we agree to get stuff done.
I carry in my head sort of both of those models all the time. I know that the vast majority of Republican voters are good people and citizens of my country and neighbors.
Yep.
I know that most elected Republican officials are well-meaning and trying to do it. I get that.
Yep.
And what I've done in this podcast, for example, is interview a lot of partisans that really believe in this model, but also interview people like you who are trying in a bipartisan or nonpartisan fashion to fix things.
Yeah.
And I believe that both of those are good models.
Yeah.
And I think we need both of those things. But it always intrigues me to have someone who's firmly in one of those camps and says, like, this is the way to go, right?
Okay, so let's do a little bit of math. Yeah. So there are two reasons why I believe this is the way to go. Let's start with the math equation first. How many years since Ronald Reagan was inaugurated have the Democrats concurrently held the House, the Senate, and the White House, meaning held power at the same time? I mean, you could probably do this in your head.
Yeah, not enough.
Right. First 2 years of Clinton, first 2 years of Obama.
Yeah.
So four, let's just say out of 40 years, right, because we're coming up on 2021, Reagan was inaugurated in 81. Four out of 40 years, the Democrats have been running all the tables on Capitol Hill, okay? If your theory of change, regardless of what you believe in, is that we just need the Democrats to control everything and then we'll get a lot of huge stuff done and the country will change.
That's a flawed theory of change. That's what happened, say, post-Great Depression, right? You had Franklin Roosevelt and Democratic Congress for a long time. And that may have taken this country down the road to holding democracy together compared to what happened in Germany, right? In a time of enormous stress on the population with the Depression and so on, right? I understand what you're saying. Like, yes. But right now, maybe what we need is a little bit of time like that, right? After the trauma of something really beyond the pale that's going on.
Well, or maybe what we need is a period of
normalcy.
Of normalcy and legislative productivity. And to get to that point, we've got to talk about getting enough people from both sides of the aisle to work together on enough issues. So like that's the other case that I'll make to you is that there's just the pure strategy case. And by the way, the Republicans in 40 years have only concurrently held the House, the Senate, and the White House for six of those years. But the other point I'll make is philosophical, which is that when it comes to the constant renovation or upkeep of a democratic republic, that can't be a partisan thing. There are other things that we will always fight about. But when it comes to like whether or not the playing field that we all have to run on is level and the grass is cut, that's something we should do together.
The problem is that right now we have one party which is actively undermining, like, vote suppression and different things that the Republican Party is doing. The other party is not.
Well, just hold on. Okay. So let's take money in politics.
Yeah.
I mean, the Democrats haven't exactly been great on money in politics reform because at times they believe the system benefits them. They raise just as much money from the lobbyists and special interest groups that they're aligned with as the Republicans do from the ones that they're aligned with. If you look at 2009, when Pelosi was running the House, Reid was running the Senate, and Obama was in office, they were promising at that point that they would do public financing for campaigns, you know, game-changing political reform. They never got around to it. So that's on money in politics, that's one point to keep in mind. On gerrymandering, I mean, I live in Maryland, where we effectively gerrymandered away the only Republican district that was left in the state a couple years ago. So the Democrats, after the 2000 census, were very effective at doing gerrymandering. And yeah, then the Republicans after the 2010 census did a bunch of gerrymandering too. So both parties have been kind of playing the game pretty hard. What we're calling for at this point is enough of a detente that we can get good people on both sides of the aisle to work together on behalf of reform.
I think there's quite a distinction between the parties, but I take your point. You have 30 people working here.
Yeah.
What are they doing?
They produce reports.
Yeah.
We do some investigative reporting on dark money, to expose dark money and to kind of point out what's wrong with the system and do the kind of work that, you know, used to get done by the major papers but isn't anymore. And then we've got a communication shop that cranks out lots of messages on a regular basis. So we do write op-eds and we land them all over the place and we get on television and radio and stuff like that and get quoted in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. And then we've got a legislative shop, and they work on getting on the Hill. So we've done 250 meetings on the Hill, most of them with senators or members of Congress in the last 12 months. And that's just the grind. You just got to get up there and get around.
Before issue one came to being, there were already existing many political reform institutions of long standing.
Yep.
What is different about issue one that wasn't there with Common Cause or a million other groups that have been fighting this fight in different ways?
Well, first of all, before I get to that, I will say that the political reform sector is probably the most underinvested in sector in America. We at one point did a landscape scan of the field when we first started doing this work. And just if you look at money in politics alone, it's maybe about $30 or $35 million is spent annually on organizations that work on money in politics. So if you take the piece of Public Citizen, the piece of the Brennan Center, the piece at US PIRG,
Open Secrets,
all of their budget, but their budget's like $2
million. Yeah.
The piece of Common Cause that works on money in politics, it's about $25 or $30 million annually.
Yeah.
Okay. That is chump change. I mean, it's literally what a house in Hollywood would cost a movie mogul these days. So it's incredibly underinvested in. And just to give your listeners a sense, there are about $400 billion is spent annually by American philanthropists, religion, you know, education, giving to colleges and universities, healthcare, giving to hospitals and community health centers and stuff like that. Environment. They get huge, huge, huge investments in other sectors of society. When it comes to actually maintaining and protecting our democracy, it's infinitesimal. So the amount of philanthropy that's just spent on the money in politics piece annually is about 0.01% of philanthropy.
Something like $500 million, right? Isn't it?
That's a very generous number. So that number includes any organization that works on any kind of political reform.
Yeah.
Plus nonprofit media, including NPR, you know, big.
Does that include NPR?
Yeah, includes. That's about the most generous number that you could find. That still is like
a fraction of philanthropy. So does that mean that your ambition with issue one is to be a very large?
I think the entire field of political reform has to scale in the next 10 years substantially. Yeah. We need organizations. So instead of Common Cause having a budget of, I think it's $12 million or so, they should have a budget of $80 million. I mean, NRDC in the environmental field, they've got a budget of $120 million. Sierra Club has a budget of
ACLU about picked up a huge amount.
ACLU is at like $150 million.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what scale looks like in other sectors.
Yep.
in our sector at $5 million, believe it or not, we are one of the biggest political reform groups in the country with 30 staff. So we've got to deal with the scale issue if we're going to have an effective, permanent protector and defender of democracy. And then in terms of what makes us unique and the reason why we started the organization, we did feel as if there was a need for a group that really believed in reaching out to both sides.
Yeah.
And so we pursue everything here in what we call a Noah's Ark fashion. So if we get a Democrat on a bill, we get a Republican or vice versa,
mm-hmm.
which is why we've got, I think, 26 now on our FEC bill in the House, 13 R's, 13 D's. We could do 13 R's and then go get 200 D's. But the moment you do that, you capsize the boat and you can't get it done then. So we try to pursue everything pretty methodically in that way. And we just didn't feel like enough of the organizations that are out there were doing that.
It does sound smart. And what it sounds like a method for keeping your credibility on both sides. What's the vision to expand beyond 5 million and 30 staff? Where do you want to take this?
We are currently the premier bipartisan political reform organization in Washington. I think we have the ability to expand the brand and become the premier bipartisan political reform organization in the U.S. So, you know, if you wake up tomorrow and you care about the environment, there are a bunch of brands that come to mind: NRDC, Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy. If you're more of a traditionalist, the Isaac Walton League of America, which does land conservation, Environmental Defense Fund, right? Like, there are a bunch of brands. Hopefully, 10 years from now, when people wake up and they, you know, if you wake up in Akron, Ohio, and you realize that our democracy is in trouble or needs fixing, issue one comes to mind. And you join it because it looks like an ecumenical community that does not account for partisanship. Anyone's welcome. Anyone who believes that we got to fix our political system is welcome. And then Common Cause should be at a much higher scale too. They appeal more to progressive audience at this point, but they should be at a much, much bigger scale also.
Why did you call it issue one?
To make the theory of change, which is that this has got to be the first thing we do. Fixing democracy, going back to the metaphor of the surgeon.
It's problem one.
It's problem one. Yeah. Unless we have a functional political system and our ability to effectively govern, then no other problem gets fixed at scale. We'll tinker around the margins and we'll tweak things here and there, as we kind of did with Obamacare, but nothing's going to really get fixed. So it's issue one. It's step one.
We're in the middle of a political primary right now, and some candidates on the Democratic side are sort of, I would say, echoing your interest in governing in a more bipartisan fashion. Governor of Montana, maybe Biden, yep, talking about like he can work with both sides.
Yep.
Others are more partisan or more on the fringe of the ideological spectrum. Are you rooting for a moderate Democrat to come out that can work in a bipartisan fashion? How do you fit into the politics of the day?
I'm probably not going to answer that one because I've got my issue one hat on right now,
yeah,
as opposed to my just Nick.
But just in terms,
but here's what I will, yeah, say: I talk to and work with and have family members and I used to vote Republican who are Republicans. Some of them are more conservative. Some of them are moderate. And then I talk to a lot of independents too, people that are just kind of like they're sick, just burnout on both parties. They feel like both parties are just children. They can't get anything done. There is an historic opportunity to go grab those people and realign politics for a generation. You remember when Reagan reached out to the unions and there was, so they became what was known as the Reagan Democrats. He realigned the political situation for, I don't know what, a decade at least, based on the fact that he could go get those traditional Democratic voters and pull them in just by force of his personality and his ideas. At this point, obviously, we just know from the polling, so this is not a partisan thing to say, this is just an objective reality. There's, 30 to 40% of the voting public is still enamored enough with Trump that they're willing to back him. But that means that 60% is not, and is out there looking for the right political configuration that they can get behind. So the Democrats, it seems like they've got an historic opportunity to reach out to a lot of these folks who just can't stomach Trump anymore. But they're never going to get to them if they have a divisive message and if they're shaming those people and saying, oh, all those people are, you know, whoever voted for Trump is, or whoever even enabled Trump, they're racist and they're this and that, and throwing labels at them. Don't do that, you know? I mean, I just think it's a horrible mistake. It's also just going to create more division in the end.
I think I agree with that. Reform of our system has rarely been the top polling issue of the day. It seems to be hard to drive people to get exercised about the shape of congressional districts or some of the other inside baseball things that you're working on that are so important. How do you politically pull people into understanding how important this is?
Yeah, well, again, that's why we call it Issue One, because we, you know, we do is we go out and make the case, depending on the audience, that whatever they care about is not going to get done under the current conditions. So whether you care about the cost of prescription drugs because your grandma's having to cut her pills in half, you can't get that done unless we do some kind of federal legislation. But that to do the federal legislation, we got to first have a political system that isn't being controlled by the pharmaceutical companies. Whether you care about a balanced budget and tackling the national debt, there's no way that we can tackle that problem unless we have a functional political system where meaningful compromises, including ones that cause a little bit of pain, can be made. So, A, we go out and we make that case, basically the case of the theory of change case. The second one is that people are more panicked than they ever have been. So I don't think it's, yeah, I do have it on my wall still. So annually, the American Psychological Association asks people, it's twice a year, they ask them about stressors in their lives. So this is not what's wrong with the world. This is like what, when you wake up and are just going about your life, driving to your job at the grocery store, sitting at your house, what causes you stress in your life? So here's the one from about 8 months ago. Number one, common stressor in people's lives, the future of the nation, okay? Number two, money, meaning like I don't have enough. Yeah. Number three, work, which basically means my boss sucks or I don't like what's going on in my work. Number four, the current political climate. So one and four of the top four stressors in people's lives are basically what they see going on in Washington every day.
And that was surveyed like a random sample of Americans? Or
yeah.
Was that,
yeah. Yeah, it's a random sample of Americans that the American Psychological Association does twice a year. So people are freaked out.
Yeah.
It's causing them personal stress
yeah.
in a major way.
I'm in that group.
We all are, right? And they're searching for solutions. You know, there are all kinds of problems, right? A, there are no big brand name organizations. I include ours in that. So if you wake up in Akron, Ohio tomorrow and you're stressed, you have no idea of who to turn to. Whereas if you wake up tomorrow and you're stressed about animals, you can say, oh, the Humane Society, the ASPCA or whatever, right? There's no one to turn to. Number two, there is profound cynicism. So even if you wake up and you're stressed about it, right after you get over your stress, the first thing you're going to say to yourself is, oh, those assholes will never fix it anyway because Washington's just irreparably broken. Nothing can change it. This is why people voted for Donald Trump. This is why a lot of people voted for Donald Trump. They weren't, as the left would like to say, just a bunch of racist, you know, retrograde folks who wanted the country
to— They want to turn a few tables upside down.
Yeah, they sent the bull into the China shop. Mm-hmm. They wanted the bull to go into the China shop and to wreck the China shop because the China shop wasn't working. And so I think that in many ways, there was an act of almost self-conscious destruction that many voters were doing, just like, yeah, let's monkey wrench it. Let's gum up the system. Let's see if this guy can go in there and change things because he's so outside the box.
Wouldn't the voters then, in response to it probably having gotten even worse, try to outdo that in the next one?
Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah,
we'll see what they're looking for. If they're looking for more of the kind of strife or if they're looking for repair at this point.
Who do you see as your best allies in this fight?
There's like a long-standing community of political reform groups like Common Cause and Public Citizen and the Brennan Center and others. And we do work with them on some stuff when and where we can. But we're really focused on going out and trying to broaden that army, broaden that phalanx out. We work with a Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, for instance, which is a very bipartisan organization, did the Simpson-Bowles deal on the debt. A lot of moderate Republican business leaders and folks like that. We work with Stand Up Republic, which is founded by Evan McMullen, who I think you interviewed, right?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty aligned with you, I would say, yeah. on this. Yeah.
Exactly. He's yeah. He's a conservative.
Smart guy.
Republican, yeah.
But like an anti-Trump Republican.
Well, yeah, but then we work with Take Back Our Republic, which was run by a guy named John Pudner, who ran Dave Bratt's campaign against Eric Cantor. He was kind of like the part of the insurgent Tea Party Republican movement. I think that many of John's members of his organization probably are still very much in the Trump camp. So, you know, there's a whole host of people out there, like you and me, who are profoundly concerned about the future of our democracy and our political system. They just haven't been reached out to. So what we're doing is going and reaching out to them.
I assume as the person running this, a lot of your job, in addition to being spokesman for it, is to bring in the money, to scale this up to $5 million, which is a lot of money, and well beyond. What do you find is the pitch that works?
The big pitch, big picture pitch is this. We're living in an era right now that is being defined by a standoff between authoritarianism and democracy, and we have to win that fight. Winning that fight means that we've got to fix our political system. There are a number of ways that we've got to do that. We as Issue One are on Capitol Hill every single day talking to Republicans and Democrats, trying to find that Venn diagram overlap of where we can get stuff done, where there's enough heat to get stuff done, to begin pushing forward what we believe will be the beginning of an era of reform. We need fuel to do it. So it depends on who I'm talking to. With some donors, there's a more specific pitch. So for instance, I was just in California for a week raising money, and I talked a lot about protecting the election for 2020. You know, that's what's on people's minds.
Yeah.
Is Russia and Iran going to be able to mess with our election or not? Are they going to be able to mess with us or not? And so we've got this Don't Mess With Us campaign where we're working with Senators Grassley, Langford, Rubio, Graham, and others to get some election protections in place now before January so that we can minimize. There's still going to be interference, but we want to minimize it. And that works well for certain donors because it feels very immediate.
Is that protect the elections from what sort of threats? There's obviously threats that range from hacking into machines that all the way out to misinformation.
Right now, Langford's bill would do paper ballots, would require paper ballots, and it would provide money to the Secretary of State to update their software.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a lesser chance of getting hacked. So that's the first bill that we're pushing, the most immediate bill that we're pushing. Mm-hmm. The next one down is Senator Grassley's two bills to deal with foreign lobbyists. So this is the Paul Manafort problem, so that when you're lobbying on behalf of a foreign country, you have to disclose it, a lot of information about what you're doing. But also this thing called the Shell Company Abuse Act. So here's what's starting to happen. You know, you've heard about dark money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, dark money used to be people making donations to organizations called 501c4 organizations, and you know what those are. But for your listeners, those are charitable organizations that don't have to disclose their donations. And increasingly, since the mid-2000s, have gotten very involved in political stuff. It used to be that was dark money. Well, now what's happening is that people are starting LLCs, corporations in Delaware. So you and I will start one. We'll call it like the Brown Desk LLC. Money will be pumped into the Brown Desk LLC. You have no idea where, right? Because the corporation could be a Russian oligarch, could be the government of Iran, could be a bunch of big liberal donors or big conservative donors. That LLC will then either directly make political expenditures, which they can do because of Citizens United and some other rulings, or that LLC will then make a contribution to a super PAC. Now, the super PAC has to disclose its donations. So when they can disclose, they'll say, oh, well, sure, Brown Desk LLC gave us $50 million. Well, that's great, but you have no idea what Brown Desk LLC was, right? So it's the new kind of dark money vehicle, and we're working on that. And then the third is the Honest Ads Act, which, again, would provide transparency for political advertising because most of the political ad dollars are moving online. But when they move online, there's no transparency at all for them. So those are very here and now. All these pistons, unfortunately, will be firing in the 2020 cycle, and we're trying to, like, you know, clamp down on them.
That's pretty daunting. It seems to me like one of the most crucial things to be, it's probably controversial here, but that we could do in a bipartisan basis right now is impeach this president. And the only way he can be convicted is by both parties. And there might be a debate right now about whether he merits that, but I don't think there actually is in private. I think actually, if you privately poll U.S. senators, there's a lot of indication out of the Republicans that they know that this is not an appropriate person to be running the country. You're in a position where you're talking to both parties, where you're trying to protect democracy. Do you think there's a route and a strategy to moving through impeachment on a bipartisan basis? And would you touch that with a 10-foot
pole? No, we don't. It's because, again, we got to kind of stay in our lane here, which is that we found a lot of Republicans on both sides, in both the chamber, both chambers, the House and the Senate, and then we found a lot of them outside of Congress who are ready to lean into reform. There's just no point in us wading into the impeachment situation. Interestingly, though, just on the transparency front, I will tell you that there are a group of liberals in Boston, and I'm trying to remember the name of the group now, but they're anti-transparency. And the reason why they are, in all kinds of ways, and the reason why they are is because they actually think that it would allow members of Congress, including Republicans, to take bolder votes on things if those votes weren't disclosed. So imagine tomorrow if there were a vote on gun control and you didn't have any idea who voted for what, right? It reduces the power of the NRA. If there were a vote on impeachment tomorrow and no one had to disclose which way they voted, you might find more people being willing to break with the party. Who knows?
It's a super tricky thing to think through, right?
Yeah.
Because you want a system where elected members are responsive to their constituencies, but you don't really want a system where they're hyper-responsive to big donors and whoever is their part of the primary electorate,
right?
Rather than the people throughout their district and how they're best served.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, and I agree. We definitely stand on the side of transparency, but I can tell you, just intellectually speaking,
I think there would certainly be better results in certain cases.
Yeah. Yes. And this is all because, all for bad reason, right? Which is the lack of guts on behalf of some of our elected officials. If they're not willing, you know, privately they're willing to take a tough vote, but publicly they're not willing to because they're afraid of the repercussions. That's just, you know, it goes to their lack of integrity. But hey, in the absence of integrity, it's intriguing to think about what a little less transparency could accomplish.
I think of you as a political entrepreneur. You're building a political organization from scratch. What else could you be, right? What have you learned about doing that in this space that you could share with other people?
I guess as it is with any entrepreneur, and you've been one too, never stick to a multi-year plan. And what I mean by that is, you know, there are all kinds of people who create like a product and they think that they're going to be able to create a specific product in a specific way, and then they're going to sell it to a specific market in a specific way. Well, the best entrepreneurs actually find out along the way that that might still be true, but there are actually two other, three other ways they could sell their product if they just change it a little bit or modify it a little bit. Yeah. And they open up whole sales channels, revenue channels that they didn't know existed. I think we found the same thing. I mean, we were exclusively focused on money and politics when we started. And, you know, we've got a couple bills that are moving around on the Hill. But what we realized is you kind of have to go where the heat is. And if there wasn't, at that moment, heat on money and politics, then we're going to lean into election security and anti-foreign interference because that's where the heat is. So I think that being flexible and being able to go to where the heat is to try to accomplish stuff is really, really important. But the key is that you've got to explain that to your donors and your members along the way. So we have like 75,000 people on our email list, and then we've got 50 to 70 people who give us substantial amounts of money. You've got to make sure that they understand why you're pivoting. Otherwise, they're going to call you up and they're going to say, wait a second, why are you working on election security? What in the world are you working that for? Right. Your money and politics.
You got to take them along with you.
Yeah, you got to say, well, the reason why is because we saw the opportunity to work with Senator Lankford, you know, and Senator Grassley. And these are people that we probably wouldn't be able to work with otherwise. And if we can build affinity and connection to them on election security, then we can parlay that into a conversation about something else down the road. Politics is like, this is the other thing I've learned, because I was a journalist before this for 20 years. And, you know, the job of a journalist is largely a job of antagonism. You don't really want to have a deep friendship or relationship with who you're covering. With politics, it's really about relationships. You know, remarkable things can happen if you walk into offices and you're not vilifying someone and saying you're corrupt and a terrible person and you're a part of this horrible system.
That sounds like it's maybe enjoyable for you to have changed that relationship with the political system. When I talk to you, I get the sense that you've found a real spot for yourself, like that this is kind of a culmination of a career into this this point? Why is this a good job for Nick?
I think it's a good job because I think I'm not a very religious person. So if I have a religion, it's as corny as this sounds, it is democracy. It is, I think that it's a transcendent idea and ideal for humanity. I think we're losing it, obviously. Right now we're losing the grand battle between authoritarianism and democracy, which scares me to death. But I know too that if we aren't, to just extend the religious metaphor, I want to belong to an ecumenical church. I want to belong to a church that welcomes anyone. And I know that that's probably the best path and route in the long term to creating a stronger democracy is to say, listen, we might totally disagree on guns or abortion or the size of government or taxation, but let's agree that while we have those other arguments, let's find what we do agree on. And we agree on this. You know, it's kind of like a town's baseball team, right? It's like the thing that can unite a town is they might totally disagree on everything else, but they agree that the Nats are worth rooting for. And I find that we've got to kind of make democracy like that. Again, we've got to make it like the town baseball team where we can fight about all kinds of other stuff, but let's come together on this topic.
If you indulge me for a second, I'm curious enough about how you got here to get you to recount that a little bit. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to college? What was the first couple jobs?
I grew up in St. Louis, again, in a Republican family and community, turned 18, voted for H.W. Bush over Dukakis. Went to college at St. Lawrence University, where I was a philosophy major. All along the way, you know, was kind of very involved in class president and head of the debate team and all that kind of stuff, but also volunteering for homeless organizations and inner city youth organizations. And then got out of college and with a philosophy degree, right? Which, of course, for everyone just seems utterly impractical. What do you do with that? But got a job as a newspaper editor and ran a weekly newspaper for a couple years. And then...
What was that called?
It was called the Lincoln Journal. It was in Lincoln, Massachusetts, which is one of the birthplaces of the Republic, of course, of the Revolution. And then jumped into democracy work for a little while, running a group called the Alliance for Democracy, just through a bunch of random circumstances. It had been founded by a guy who founded the Texas Observer magazine, which is one of the best political magazines in the country when he was running it. And so I was kind of really impressed by him and ran that group for a while, which worked on money and politics and corporate globalization. You remember the showdown in Seattle in 99 around the WTO while we were there. And then back into journalism at the American Prospect magazine as an editor, and then the Washington Monthly magazine as a publisher along the way. Worked with Bill Moyers, the broadcaster, on a bunch of different media projects. Had been friends with Arianna Huffington, who called me up and wanted to do investigative journalism as part of the expansion of HuffPost back in 07, 09. So Rand started the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, which was great, where we hired a team of the best investigative reporters in the country that we had poached from the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Newsweek, Seattle Times. And it was right at the height of the financial meltdown and the Great Recession. And we just slammed the banks and the credit rating agencies and dug into them really hard.
Does that still exist as a unit of HuffPost?
Yeah. No, when HuffPost was bought by AOL, that unit went away because it was a nonprofit. It was funded as a nonprofit, kind of riding alongside HuffPost, and the AOL people couldn't wrap their heads around it.
A shame, I think.
I agree. Yeah, yeah. I agree because investigative journalism, as you know, is being depleted. It's being depleted, and it's like the platinum of journalism. I mean, we need that as a country, and we were spending $3.5 million a year just on investigative. So, it's too bad. So I came to Washington in 2002, and I just like over and over and over again, all the really great stories that I was involved in, either as a reporter, an editor, or as a publisher, in some way led back to money and politics. Why, when Obamacare was just getting off the ground, did Barack Obama, why was one of his first moves to dispatch Rahm Emanuel to go sit down with pharma and basically say to pharma, we will not touch drug pricing as long as you don't attack us on all the other stuff we're going
to
do.
Because he was trying to learn from what happened to the Clinton plan.
Sure, of course. Yeah. But why did they have to do that, right? Like,
because
why do you have to go?
There's a lot of power there. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And what's the power? It's money and politics power.
It's money and politics and money, not just like donation money, but like they were going to running independent expenditure campaigns.
Totally.
Harry and Louise or whatever.
Totally.
Yeah.
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 So, you know, it just over and over and over again, so much of what I was concerned about led to political dysfunction. A lot of it led to money in politics, also to other dysfunctions like gerrymandering, et cetera, et cetera. But I just saw up front as a journalist the breakdown of the system.
Yeah. When we look back through American history, every era seems to be pretty grim if you look at it through those lens. But also maybe you can see the threads by which we continue to sustain as a democracy. Do you think when we look back on this period, it's going to be as grim as sort of you feel it to be right now? Or do you think it's just stretch?
No, I think it's a very dark period. We're in a rotten situation here as a country. And, you know, even folks older than you and I who are in their 80s, you know, like 40 years older than us, they admit it too. I mean, I think you look at anyone. I was listening to Shields the other day, Mark Shields, the PBS commentator. He said, we've never been this bad off. You know, even during the 60s, the cultural strife of the 60s and stuff.
Well, we had a civil war and we were killing each other.
Correct. Yeah. No. Right. I mean, you go back that far, certainly. Yeah. But yeah. In my lifetime, this began in the 1990s. I think that Bill Clinton is a profoundly morally compromised character. Did he deserve to be impeached for lying about an affair with an intern? I don't know. But arguably that began a moment of highly partisan kind of cage match politics.
Well, that was preceded by the Gingrich
revolution of 94, yeah.
And the way that he played that game.
Some of what he did makes a lot of sense. There are other things that he did to the institution of Congress that we're trying to work on today. So, for instance, he gutted a lot of the research services in Congress, which meant that what does that
OTA
do?
OTA right? or, you know, all, yeah, all yeah, these
Congressional
different.
Congressional Research Service, right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he removed the brains from the institution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you do that, then you've got if you're a member of Congress, you can therefore only rely on think tanks or lobbyists, right? So it started with in the 90s. It got worse in the 2000s, and it's worse today. So my metaphor for this is that, like, the drunk has been stumbling through the halls of the House for a while, but hasn't up until a little couple years ago was functional enough alcoholic that we could all live with him. Well, the drunk is now passing out, like all over the place, hitting his head. And at this point, we need a massive intervention. And that's kind of what we're working on.
Well, I'm glad you're working on it. I think we do need what you're prescribing, as well as what a lot of other people are working hard on. So I thank you for that. Is there a question that I should have asked that I failed to?
I think the big question is whether or not the American people are ready to make clear in the 2020 and 2022 cycles that they're looking for people who are ready to fix the system.
I think you're right, but I think it's going to take intelligent people speaking to that in the right way. And I really hope we have that dialectic or whatever between leaders and people voting for them. I hope that we can make that happen.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question.
Uh-oh.
So if you were to, because you're obviously very progressive, I mean, can you imagine a situation in which you're sitting down at a table and breaking bread with people with whom you vehemently disagree on other topics, but you agree on gerrymandering or campaign finance or whatever?
I personally have no difficulty with that.
Yep.
I look for opportunities to talk to people I disagree with, and I learn when I do that.
Yep.
And I lament when I see I'm a partisan person, as you've perceived, but I really lament when I see people in my camp who vilify the other side. I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's helpful politically, and I think it's rude. I mean, it just doesn't pay off.
Yeah.
And so I hate reading online comment threads or whatever. Yeah. You know, it's terrible. So I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, that is an answer.
Yeah. I think my sister runs something called Spaceship Media, which tries to bring people into groups to talk across divides. So she took female Hillary voters in the Bay Area and put them together with Republican women in Alabama that voted for Trump and tried to create stories out of that. So, like, I'm very sympathetic to that notion that we need to talk to each other. I also feel like I'm in agreement a lot with people who really do see a difference at this time between the parties. And I think you have to pick one, and you have to, like, it's a time when we need to go away from the Republican model as it is currently conceived, and we need to drive them back to being a responsible party, which I think they are not at this time.
Okay, I understand that theory change, but that's why, and again, just to double down on this, I think that the other model is you go, you find the Venn diagram overlap of where you can work together.
Absolutely.
And you pursue that with great passion and integrity.
Well, it's been a real honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
Pleasure. No, great.
Thank you. That was Nick Penniman and Issue One. He's at issueone.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.